Chapter 6 Mansfield, the Retreat. On the morning of the 13th of May, 1864, we left Alexandria. The work at the falls was done. The gunboats that had lain in danger above the rapids had been brought over, one after another, by the dam and the channel made for them. For days, the whole army had felt the strain of that work. Men who had been set to marching and fighting were put to labor with timber, stone, and whatever else could be laid into the river. It was not work a soldier liked to remember as soldiering, yet without it the fleet would have been lost, and with the fleet lost, the army itself would have been in a worse condition than any of us cared to measure. When the boats came through, there was cheering and there was relief, but there was no rest in it. The same river that had held us was now the line of our retreat. We did not leave as men setting out for a new campaign. We left as men who had done what could be done and must now get away. Alexandria had been the place where the expedition paused, gathered itself, and spent its strength in saving the fleet. Once the fleet was saved, the town could not hold us. The army turned its face down the Red River, with the navy keeping near us where the river allowed, the wagon trains drawn out upon the roads, the cavalry feeling the rear and flanks, and the infantry placed where infantry was needed most. The whole movement had the look of necessity. There was order in it, but the order was stretched thin over too much ground. Our brigade moved out with the rest. The morning opened with the signs of heat already in it, and the roads promised little comfort. We did not take a straight course. The way led us round about, and before the day was done, it seemed as though we had spent more strength than the distance could show. A march of a few miles can be harder than a march twice as long when it's made in confusion, with halts and turnings, wagons blocking the way, and the men never certain whether they are to push on or wait again. We made only about 5 miles below Alexandria that first night. It was late before we came to camp. By the time the men lay down, it was near 10 o'clock. The ground was damp, and no man who could help it wanted to lie flat upon it. We found rails and made what use of them we could, putting our bodies along them to keep off the wet earth. It was not a soldier's bed, except in the sense that a soldier is often made to call any place a bed where his bones stop moving. The rails were hard. They pressed into the flesh and did not let a man forget where he lay. Yet they were better than mud and damp. We had learned by that time not to be delicate. What the record does not say. I remember the first night more by the feel of it than by the distance. 5 miles was nothing on paper. A man at home might walk it before breakfast and think little of it. But after Alexandria, after the strain at the river, after the talk of retreat had become movement, those 5 miles seemed to take us out of one condition and into another. The rail under me was narrow and unyielding. If I shifted to one side, my hip found the edge. If I shifted to the other, my shoulder took it. The night air came up from the damp ground. Men were packed near, not in comfort, but because there was only so much dry chance to be had. Some cursed softly. Some were asleep almost as soon as they stopped moving. One man laughed once, not because anything was amusing, but because the body sometimes gives out a sound when it has no better answer. I lay there with my musket near me and my haversack for what little pillow it could make, and I thought of home in the broken way a tired man thinks. Not clearly, not with sentences, more like flashes. A room, a face, a hand on a latch, then the rail under my ribs, the damp below, and the knowledge that before long we would be called up and sent forward again. At 4 o'clock on the morning of the 14th, we were off. The order came early, and there was no lingering over it. Coffee, if a man got it, was taken as a favor from chance. We moved near the river that day. The gunboats were with us in their fashion, though the river and the road were not always companions. Their guns were of more use than comfort. The enemy followed and watched, and wherever the banks or bends gave them a chance, they fired upon us from across the river or from places along it. The Navy answered with heavy guns, and when the parrots opened, the sound rolled over the water and through the timber with a force that no musketry could match. The banks were searched by shell. Places where gray coats had appeared became empty after the boats had spoken. The army stretched out until it seemed more like a moving country than a column. Wagons, troops, ambulances, artillery, cattle, stragglers, guards, cavalry, and infantry all had their place, but the place could shift with every obstruction. By afternoon, our brigade was near the rear of a line that was said to be about 18 miles long. Whether any man measured it exactly, I cannot say, but it felt that long and longer. The head of the column might be in one world, while the rear was still in another. Orders took time to come back. Dust, heat, and rumors traveled faster than staff officers. One could hear firing ahead or behind and not know whether it concerned us immediately or only belonged to the general music of retreat. We were not marching away from danger so much as carrying danger with us. The enemy was never so far off that we could forget him. He knew our course. He knew that the army was encumbered. He knew that a retreating column, stretched over miles of road and tied to a fleet and trains, must show weak places. The Confederates did not need to stop the whole army at once. They needed only to strike where the line bent, where the wagons choked, where cavalry was thin, where a bayou crossing held us in place, or where night found men too weary to rise quickly. Sunday, the 15th, was one of the trying days. Our regiment was in the rear, next to the cavalry. That position gave us a full share of waiting. We stood in one place until 5 o'clock in the afternoon. To stand under arms for hours can wear a man almost as much as marching. The feet ache, the shoulders grow sore under the straps, and the mind has nothing to do but attend to sounds. The gunboats could be heard on the river. Their firing came at intervals, sometimes near enough to sharpen every face, sometimes distant enough to leave us guessing. General A.J. Smith with the 16th Corps was moving in line, and the enemy came near us more than once. Each time the brigade was drawn up to receive him. There is a particular feeling in waiting for an attack that may not come. In battle, when the firing begins in earnest, fear is mixed with occupation. A man loads, aims, fires, dresses on the line, obeys what he can hear, and lets the rest fall away. But when a brigade is formed and held, facing an enemy that is felt rather than seen, the mind has too much room. Every movement in the timber becomes important. Every horseman coming back at speed brings questions with him. Every gunshot at the front or flank seems to be the first word of something larger. The artillery and cavalry did most of the work that afternoon. They drove the enemy back when he pressed too close. One cavalryman was killed, and several were wounded. We saw enough of the affair to know that the Confederates meant to hang upon us, yet not enough to call it a settled engagement for our regiment. At 6 o'clock, we started again. The long waiting had not rested us. It had only stiffened us. We marched until 1 o'clock in the morning, then had a short rest. At daylight, we were moving again. By the 16th, we were near Marksville. We marched about 3 miles, then halted for breakfast. The halt lasted until 10 o'clock, and those hours were precious. Men made coffee, chewed what food they had, loosened shoes, and stretched themselves on the ground where they could. The country opened into prairie, and that openness gave a different character to the day. In the timber, a man is closed in by what he cannot see. On prairie, he sees too much, and the distances deceive him. Troops and guns stand out plainly, but it is hard to judge how soon they will be upon each other. Heavy artillery firing began, and the expectation passed along the line that we would have a battle near Marksville. The brigade was drawn into line on the prairie. We could see cavalry skirmishing. Their movements had the look of a screen before a larger force, advancing and retiring, firing, shifting, making the enemy show himself if he meant to stand. We watched closely. believing each moment might bring us into it. The Confederates did not make the stand we expected. Whether they found our line too strong, or whether their purpose was only to delay and worry us, I cannot say. They gave way, and the army moved on. That day showed how uncertain the retreat was. A man could be called from breakfast to line of battle, from line of battle to marching order, from marching order to a halt, and from a halt to night movement. We stopped at 6 o'clock in the evening and rested until 9. It was a poor kind of rest, measured by the clock and taken with shoes on. Then we marched another hour and stopped again. The body begins to lose its sense of regular time under such use. Morning, noon, and night still come, but they do not govern anything. Orders govern, roads govern, bayous govern, the enemy governs. Hunger and sleep take what space is left. On the 17th, we made coffee and marched across a bayou. The crossings were among the worst parts of the movement. A bayou could hold a column like a hand on the throat. Wagons must be got through. Artillery must be managed. Men must cross in order or in such disorder as could be endured. If a bridge was poor, it must be strengthened. If no bridge served, rafts or makeshifts must be used. The enemy understood this as well as we did. Whenever the column was delayed at water, the rear was in danger. The enemy attacked the cavalry in the rear that day, but was driven back. We kept moving. At 10 o'clock at night, we came to another bayou, a place where the enemy had taken 2 wagons the day before. The knowledge of that loss was enough to make every man look more closely into the dark. Men were rafted over. Night crossings have their own confusion. The water is black, voices carry strangely, and the weight of men and arms on uncertain footing makes even small movements slow. A man thinks of his cartridge box, his musket, and his balance all at once. The officers press the line forward, but no command can make water solid. The enemy attacked the cavalry again near Bayou de Glaize. General Smith's 16th Corps marched back in relief. They met the enemy, scattered him, and took prisoners. That movement steadied the rear and gave us room to pass on. It was a comfort to know that troops capable of striking hard were there when needed. In such a retreat, confidence does not come from distance gained only. It comes from seeing that the enemy cannot do as he pleases with the rear of the column. We marched on and crossed at Fort Morganza on a pontoon bridge made of steamboats. It was an extraordinary sight, though by then we were too tired to give wonder its full due. Steamboats, which belonged by nature to the river's length, had been made to serve across it. Planks and ways were laid, and the army passed over. The crossing of a body of troops is never a silent thing. Feet sound on the bridge, wheels jar, animals balk, officers call, teamsters swear, and the river moves below as if indifferent to all of it. Yet such a bridge was a promise. Each regiment that crossed was that much farther from the enemy's best chance. The heat that day was very great. It bore down upon the column and rose up from the road. Men drank when they could and wanted more as soon as they had swallowed. The dust clung to sweat and made a paste on faces and hands. Clothing grew stiff with it. The straps of the knapsack and cartridge box rubbed sore places sorer. There was no privacy in discomfort. Every man saw the same signs in every other man. The bent neck, the open mouth, the slow step after a halt, the quick glance toward any shade. On the 18th, when we were 2 or 3 miles off, the Confederates attacked the 16th Corps, or a part of it, and there was a hard fight. We were not in the full of that fight, but the sound and reports reached us. The Union men beat them and took more than 200 prisoners. The dead and wounded were left on the field. That last fact stayed with me. In an advance, after a battle, the field may be held, the wounded gathered, the dead buried with more care, and the place made part of the army's possession. In a retreat, everything is shortened. Time is short. Wagons are short. Strength is short. Even mercy is put under the limits of movement. Men do what can be done, not what would be done if the army could stop and breathe. The fight of the 18th proved again that the enemy was not content to follow at a distance. He struck at the force guarding the rear and learned the cost of it. The prisoners taken were evidence enough that his boldness had met a firm answer. Still, every such affair had two meanings for us. It showed that our troops could beat back attack, and it showed that attack was still near. Victory in the rear did not remove the need to march. It only kept the road open. By then, the retreat had become a rhythm of marching, halting, forming, listening, and moving again. Men spoke less than they had earlier in the campaign. There are stages of fatigue. At first, men complain freely. Then they joke. Then they grow silent. After that, they become capable of sudden anger over small things. A place at a fire. A cup of coffee spilled. A man stepping on another's blanket. But the anger burns out quickly, because there is not strength to feed it. What remains is obedience and habit. The file closes because it has closed before. The musket is lifted because it must be lifted. The feet move because the feet ahead move. On the 19th, we marched about 3 miles to the transport on the old river, where there was a fleet of steamboats. The sight of transports brought a different feeling into the men. Boats meant movement without the road, or at least the support of a route we could understand. They meant connection with the river system that had brought us into Louisiana and might take us out of the worst of it. Yet a fleet lying ready also meant more waiting, more crossings, more crowding of men and animals and wagons into places where one mishap could delay thousands. The old river was spoken of among the men as the old Mississippi, a large bayou or watercourse that held its own history in its bends and banks. To us, it was another barrier to be crossed and another measure of progress toward safety. On the 20th at noon, we crossed it on a pontoon bridge made of steamboats. Again, the boats were turned into a road. There was skill in the arrangement and necessity behind the skill. Men may not praise engineers every day, but when an army stands before deep water with the enemy behind it, every plank laid right is worth a sermon. All were across by night. That crossing changed the temper of the movement. Once the army was over, we were out of the enemy's reach in the sense that had troubled us most. Not free of all danger, not at ease, not restored, but beyond the immediate grip that had held the rear and flanks for days. Men could feel it. The talk changed. Faces loosened. A soldier does not need a formal announcement to know when the worst pressure has lifted. He reads it in officers' bearing, in the way guards are posted, in the way men are allowed to rest. We rested until 10 o'clock that night. Then the march began again for the Mississippi. The thought of that river had drawn us for days. The Red River campaign had made water both enemy and friend. Low water had trapped the fleet. The riverbanks had given the enemy places to fire from. Bayous had slowed us. Yet the great river still meant communication, supply, and the road back into the Union's stronger hold. To reach the Mississippi was to pass from a country where every mile seemed contested into one where the army could gather itself. Night marching toward the Mississippi had a strange quality. The heat of the day lessened, but did not disappear. Men moved in darkness, keeping touch by sound and shape. The road could be felt through the soles more than seen. A stumble passed down a file almost like a word. The creak of wagons, the clink of canteens, the mutter of voices, the occasional command from an officer, and the steady tramp of feet made the night alive. A man walking half asleep can still keep his place. He learns the distance between himself and the haversack in front of him. He knows the pace by the rise and fall of the line. He dreams while moving, then wakes with a start and finds he has not fallen out. On the 21st, we reached the Mississippi by 11 o'clock in the morning at the mouth of the Red River. That was a landmark more important to us than any town. The meeting of the rivers stood for the end of one kind of trial. We had come down from Alexandria, through the delays, alarms, bayous, and rearguard fighting, and there was the Mississippi broad before us. I do not say the men became cheerful all at once. Fatigue does not leave a body because a river is reached. But there was satisfaction. The army had not been cut off. The fleet had not been lost above the falls. The long column had not been broken in retreat. We had been pressed, but we had come through. The mouth of the Red River was no place of rest for sentiment. It was a military point, crowded with movement and purpose. Boats, troops, supplies, and orders belonged to it. Still, I marked it in my mind. A soldier marks such places. He may not know what history will call them, and he does not need to know. He knows where he was hungry, where he was afraid, where he crossed water under threat, where he slept on rails, where he heard guns, where he saw prisoners brought in, and where he first felt that a hard passage had been made. On Sunday morning, the 22nd, at 3 o'clock, we were moving down the river. The early hour was no surprise by then. Sleep had become something taken in fragments, and the call to move before dawn belonged to the same order of things as dust and sore feet. We went downriver on a journey that proved tiresome despite the nearness of the great line of communication. It was very hot. Heat on the river has its own oppression. The water may promise coolness to the eye, but the air can hang heavy over it, and the sun can strike from above while glare comes back from below. Men crowded together feel the heat of one another, as well as of the weather. That day, letters from home reached us. There are few things in army life that can change the state of a man more quickly. Food, rest, dry socks, and a safe camp all have their value, but a letter can reach a place none of them can touch. Men who had been worn down by marching and heat took paper from home into their hands and were, for a little while, lifted out of the column. The road, the river, the enemy, and the fatigue remained, but they no longer filled the whole mind. I received letters, too, and the sight of the familiar hand and the knowledge of those who had written did more to ease me than I could have expected. The body may be tired past repairing in one day, but the heart can be strengthened in a moment. A man who has carried himself like part of a machine remembers that he is also husband, father, son, brother, neighbor, and friend. He remembers rooms and fields, voices at home, concerns that are smaller than armies and therefore dearer. He learns that while he has been measuring time by marches and firing, those at home have been measuring it by silence and waiting. I do not mean that letters remove the soldier from war. They can make the war sharper. News from home reminds him what may be lost and what he is absent from. A child's growth, a wife's burden, the work of a farm, the illness of kin, the small troubles that become large when one is away, all these come folded in paper. Yet even when the news carries care, the letter is proof of connection. It says that the world before the army still exists, and that one has not been swallowed entirely by the campaign. The men around me showed the same change. Some read quickly and put the letters away. Some read slowly, as if each line must be held before moving to the next. Some asked another to read for them, or to make out a difficult hand. Some smiled without speaking. Some turned aside. There were men who had no letter and tried not to show what they felt. There were men who shared news from home with messmates because any home news was better than none. For a time, the weariness of the day was less noticed. The letters did not give strength to the legs, but they gave the mind another place to stand. We camped that night at a place on the river, 18 miles below the mouth of the Red River. The army had passed from the immediate retreat into another stage, but I did not yet think of it in any large way. I knew only that we had come through many difficult days and that I had paper before me and much to write. The camp had the usual sounds of men settling after movement, Fires were made where they could be. Coffee was prepared. Equipment was set down. Some men talked over the days just past, arranging them in memory by the order of hardships. Others had no wish to speak of them. They lay down as soon as duty allowed. When I looked back over the days from Alexandria to that camp, the movement did not appear as a neat line. It came in pieces. The first night below Alexandria, with rails for a bed. The early start near the river. The gunboats clearing the banks. The long column, too long for any one man to know in full. The Sunday waiting near the rear, with the cavalry close and the enemy pressing. The march to 1 o'clock in the morning. The prairie near Marksville and the expectation of battle. The bayous, each with its delay and danger. The night crossing where wagons had been taken before. Bayou de Glaze and Smith's men going back to strike. The steamboat bridge at Fort Morganza. The heat. The fight behind us on the 18th. The prisoners. The old river. The crossing by steamboats again. The Mississippi reached. The letters. It is easy, after a campaign, for men to speak of it by names, as if the names contain the experience. Alexandria, Marksville, Bayou de Glaze, Fort Morganza, the mouth of Red River. But names do not carry the weight of a cartridge box at the end of a hot day. They do not give the taste of coffee made in haste, or the feeling of being halted in line while cavalry fights ahead, or the sound of naval guns searching the timber. They do not show how a man can sleep on a rail because the ground is worse, or how a letter can make a weary camp seem nearer to home than any map would allow. The retreat taught me again that an army is made not only of battles. Battles are the parts most easily told, but the marching between them wears the men down in another fashion. A battle has a beginning that can be remembered, and an end that can be marked, even when the field is confused. A retreat like ours is continuous. It enters the feet, the shoulders, the stomach, and the temper. It makes every halt uncertain and every start unwelcome. It gives no man the satisfaction of advancing, yet demands the same courage. The rear guard must be ready to fight while the trains move. The infantry must stand when told and march when told. The cavalry must feel the enemy and pay for that knowledge. The artillery must be brought through. The engineers must make roads where water says none exists. The navy must guard the river and clear the banks. All must work together, or all may suffer. I do not write this to make the retreat appear more desperate than it was. We were not a mob. We were not broken. The army had commanders, order, and fighting strength. The enemy troubled us, attacked us, and watched for advantage. But he did not destroy us. More than once he came near enough to test the rear, and more than once he was driven back. The 16th Corps did hard service and gave the enemy reason to keep his distance. The gunboats did their part where the river brought them within reach. The bridges made of steamboats carried us over waters that might otherwise have delayed us dangerously. These things should be remembered. But neither should the difficulty be softened. Men were worn. The heat was severe. The roads and crossings were trying. The column was long and vulnerable. We marched at hours when the body expected sleep. We halted in places where the mind expected attack. We heard firing often enough that silence itself became suspicious. We were glad to reach the Mississippi because we knew what lay behind us. That night, as I sat with paper and pen, I had the feeling that the days needed to be set down before they blurred into one another. I had written home before and would write again, not as an historian, but as a man trying to tell those dear to him where he had been and how he had fared. There was too much to say in full, and yet the need to say it was strong. A soldier's letter must choose. It cannot carry all the mud, heat, fear, duty, irritation, gratitude, hunger, and longing of a march. It can only place enough of the facts before the reader that love may fill the spaces. I thought of the 13th and the small distance made. I thought of the 14th and the river guns. I thought of Sunday, when we stood so long in the rear and listened. I thought of Marksville and the line on the prairie. I thought of the bayou crossings and the relief when Smith's troops went back. I thought of the steamboats made into bridges. I thought of the dead and wounded left after the fight on the 18th, and of the prisoners taken. I thought of reaching the Mississippi, and of the letters that had come to us. These were not grand reflections. They were the plain contents of recent days pressing upon the mind. The camp settled deeper into night. The river was near, carrying its own dark motion. Men slept where they could, some with letters tucked safely away, some with none to tuck. The army had moved beyond the worst reach of the enemy, but each man still carried the campaign in his body. My hand was tired before I began. My eyes wanted sleep. Yet the paper waited, and home waited beyond it. So I made ready to write.